This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
There's some truth to the statement that most people have masochistic tendencies. I see you're all back here for more. More is what I'll give you, moving on from where we left off on last Wednesday. Again, let me remind you, please, that next week it's Wednesday night again, but the following week will be Tuesday night, not Wednesday night. The first point that we made, but the most important point as far as the following is concerned, that was made last week, was the inherent differences between man and woman, and the important fact that it is through a comprehension and an understanding of those differences that man is going to find his happiness, and woman. Not in trying to find the similarities. The similarities are obvious. The joys of marriage and the joys of living together and the success of living together comes from a very clear appreciation of those differences. We made the point on Wednesday that the biological differences between man and woman transcend the biological area and enter into all the other areas, emotional, spiritual, psychological, and everything else. That exactly the same way as man and woman differ in their biological and physiological structure, so exactly, in exactly the same way, does man and woman differ in his spiritual and emotional and psychological structure. And it's that that enables man and woman to relate to one another as successfully emotionally as they are capable of relating physically and sexually. Sexually, the success rate is by no means 100%. But emotionally and spiritually and psychologically, the success rate is way below that. And I think a lot of it has to do with exactly that point. Imagine a sexual situation where husband and wife don't know the differences between each other's bodies. Imagine what chaos there would be. And there's precisely that chaos that occurs in the spiritual and psychological areas. And I'm going to show you as we proceed, particularly in the last talk, that many of the sexual problems today result from the fact that man and woman don't fully understand the physiological differences either. But that for later. Particularly we talked about the relationship which I term the Gavra and Chefza relationship, Gavra meaning the subject. In Talmudic, Halachic thought, we talk about the Gavra as the subject of a relationship. Gavra also, not coincidentally, comes from the word Gever, which means a man, or Gibor, which means a hero, and Chefza, which is the object of the relationship. Before I pursue the Gavra and Chefza relationship in the discussion that affects us tonight, I must do two things. Number one, I did promise to ask you for some of your ideas on the basis of a marriage. And number two, I've got to describe to you very briefly some of the difficulties in life that drive man and woman into each other's arms, because that's important to understand as the marriage takes off. But first, let's have a couple of ideas as to what forms the basis of a marriage. Any volunteers?
Oneness.
I think we should make a couple of notes here. Because we'll refer to them later on. Right.
Respect.
Any more? Respect. Mutual respect.
Understanding. Communication. No
interference from you. That's quite lovely.
They're not in that order.
I'm afraid in the last one you're asking for the impossible, so we're going to have to find another way around it. We're discussing the marital relationship, not how to be in-laws. Any more?
Compatibility.
Compatibility. Any other ideas?
Loyalty.
Loyalty, that's a very good one. Trust, somebody said.
Tolerance.
Tolerance. That's part of loyalty.
Set
a goal. Yeah, similarity of goals. That's an aim of marriage, not a basis of it. What do you mean by confidence? Who said that? Who said confidence? What do you mean by confidence? It's very important what you're saying. Self-esteem. How do you mean that?
Money.
Who must have money? Husband or the wife?
Both.
Okay, those are enough to start with. Inspiration.
Consideration.
Consideration. That's part of tolerance. Tolerance and consideration were good. True, nobody's mentioned it.
Need the money first.
We'll come back to that in a moment. We need to understand the one of the, I don't want to really put it as crudely as saying one of the things that drive people to marriage, but certainly one of the hang-ups with which people come to marriage. And that is a feeling of tremendous insecurity. And this is peculiar to a larger extent to our generation than it has been before. The insecurity today is something which is becoming more and more a cause of human unhappiness. Insecurity is a result of technology. Let me define insecurity first. Insecurity, it now depends whether you're a gavra or you're a chefza, right? Whether you're a subject or you're an object. Your pet dog feels insecure for different reasons than you as his master feel insecure. Your pet dog feels insecure when he feels you don't know what you're doing with him. When you take him for a walk and he gets the feeling that you don't know where you're going. When he gets away with anything and you never say no. And then sometimes you'll go into a tantrum and scream at him when he did exactly what he did yesterday and you said nothing. He doesn't know where he stands with you. A chefza feels insecure when he feels that he's not being handled. When he feels he's not being controlled. Imagine an employee. Imagine if I work for Anglo-American and I have a problem and I walk into Harry Oppenheimer and I say, Harry, friend, we've got a problem. This is the problem and I don't know what to do. And imagine if Harry put his head in his hand and said, oh, I also don't know what to do. What shall we do? What kind of security do I have? Or if I ask him, what do you think? Where should we go now? And he says, I don't know. It doesn't make much difference. The chefza, the object, which an employee is, a pet dog is, and anybody who's in a situation of fitting in to a slot where he's being handled or needs to be handled, when he feels he's not being handled professionally and competently, he feels insecure. A gavra, the subject on the other hand, feels insecure when he feels he's unable to control his objects, his chefzas. When he feels that the objects are too big, too complex to be controlled, he doesn't understand them well enough. That's when he starts feeling insecure. And feels insecure to an extent in a motor car because you understand, firstly, you don't know much about how the thing works, and secondly, at least I don't, and secondly, you have the feeling that there's a great deal which is beyond your control. You can drive very nice and quietly according to the rules and regulations, and you can still be hit by a drunkard. One feels insecure on the road because of that, because one's not in control. One feels insecure because of the advances in technology in any event. We don't feel connected. When we turn on the switch and the light goes on, we don't feel in control the same way as we would have been had we took two pieces of flint and scraped them together and made our own fire, which we made and we understand and we know how to control electricity. Who understands it? Who knows what it is? You just read about fires breaking out in people's houses because of electrical faults. The switch goes on, the switch goes off, people get shocks, people get electrocuted. There's a certain degree, it's very subconscious, it's not something we're consciously living with, but there's a feeling of alienation from the things we're handling. We're not making this electricity. Where's it coming from? Who's doing it? There's someone else organizing it from outside our houses, and we're just turning on the house, the light, and here it is. And despite all the comfort created by electricity, there's a little bit of a feeling of insecurity with it as well. How much more so about something like television, where we suddenly find that our children are talking a language and adopting a value system which they never learned from us and didn't even learn at their schools. But it's something that they're picking up through the channeling of television right into our own homes from somebody outside. Nuclear threat, the feeling that everybody walks around with, the subconscious feeling that who knows how long the world will still be around for. It's a horrible feeling. And again, a feeling which is beyond our control, there's nothing we can do about it. We feel helpless in the face of technology. And so technology which was meant to be a chetzer, technology which was meant to be an object of human use and handling, becomes the subject and starts controlling us and terrorizing us and affecting our lives in all sorts of intimate and drastic ways. And we start to feel more and more controlled by computers, by bureaucracies. All of a sudden we're a number and everybody knows about us. And you go into any government office and they've got a whole file on you. You start to be feeling insignificant in the face of our chefzes, in the face of the objects which we are meant to be handling. We suddenly start to feel that these objects are encroaching on us and we are being handled by them. And one realizes, as I spoke in shul a couple of weeks ago, a bank is really your chefzet, your object. You employ a bank to work for you. That's what it is. They make money out of you. You go there and you give them money and you deposit money with them. If you lend them money, they make money out of you. And if they lend you money, they make money out of you. So they're doing very well on the deal. Then all of a sudden you look at yourself and you find yourself cringing into your bank and praying before you go to see your bank manager that he'll receive you well and being so grateful when he does. You don't do that to the lady who serves you at the OK Bazaars. She you take for granted. All of a sudden again you find the chetzer, which is called the bank, has become a great, big, threatening colossus that keeps you lying awake at night. Maybe the bank manager will phone me because I'm 10 rand in overdraft or whatever it is. One starts getting worried about idiotic things when really he's there to serve you. And so one finds more and more in the technological and increasingly complex age in which we live, a feeling of being threatened by the very things which we created to serve our uses. We suddenly feel we are being handled by those very objects. Family used to be a place in which one could feel secure at least. Family doesn't mean only your parents, your children, your brothers and sisters. Family in the old days used to mean everybody, including the in-laws, who did interfere very effectively. Family was a big thing. Family was a little city, it was a little town. There was the feeling that family would never let you down. There was a feeling you could never be in real economic trouble. Because there would always be somebody in the family somewhere who was doing well while somebody else wasn't doing so well and they would help them out. There was just a feeling of security. There was always a feeling if you had an emotional problem, family could be called in. You didn't have to worry about babysitting. We have children. Children are also our chefzes in a sense. We'll discuss that in more detail a little bit later on. But primarily children are also objects which need to be handled and controlled to a degree by us. And all of a sudden we find our children are controlling our lives. We can't go out at night and we can't do the things we want to do anymore because we're completely homebound because of what? A 2-year-old pipsqueak. That's incredible. And we can't move. But in the old days it wasn't like that. You wanted to go out, you called in a sister or a mother or a cousin or an aunt or somebody and they moved in and they looked after you. You wanted to go on holiday by yourself, you went on holiday by yourself. Whatever you wanted to do, the family was there. It was part of their function to take over and to substitute parental roles and family roles. So the family was continuously moving. By the way, it was also a very rich experience for the children, who weren't restricted to what must become quite a boring relationship with two adults who don't know, but are able to extend that relationship into a much wider, equally intimate and equally intense system of relationships. Economics. Again, money is something we're meant to feel in control of. It's meant something we're meant to handle. I'm just skipping over these things very quickly. Really, one should give a full lecture on each one of them, but we don't have time for that. But money, too, is one of these things that one is meant to feel in control of, one's meant to use, to handle. But today we find with 20% interest rates that to keep your money just worth what it is, you've got to work like a dog. It's like walking on some kind of treadmill. If you slow down for a moment, it's not a question of making more money anymore. Now it's just a question of making sure that what you saved all your life should still be worth what it was when you saved and struggled to put it aside. It becomes, again, a threatening colossus You feel this pressure behind you all the time to keep up. And it's not just a social thing of keeping up with the Joneses. It's a serious economic pressure under which a young couple find themselves, and older couples too for that matter, find themselves from the very beginning. A constant drive and drive. And again, you can't do the things you've always wanted to do, and you can't spend the time the way you imagined you would spend the time, because if you sit back for a moment, as I say again, it's not a question that you won't make the extra 20 rand. The problem is that your 100 rand will only be worth 90 rand. It's a terrible threat. It's something, again, that we're walking around with all the time. And strangely enough, one of the most insecure-making things of all is the permissive society that was created in the 1960s. Because there used to be a time when at least we felt in control of our moral relationships. We understood what was expected of us, and we understood how to fit into those relationships and how to handle those relationships. With a permissive society where anything becomes permitted, there is nothing more insecure-making than the absence of boundaries. Can you imagine if your house just disappeared? While you were asleep, the walls of your house just came down. We're living in a free society, you'll be told. It's the in thing. Not to have walls to your house. Live in the outside. Live in the open. It's a terribly insecure-making feeling. And when the moral walls of the world came down, which they did during the 60s, the human being again started becoming very, very morally insecure. I don't say that people were more moral before the 60s. I happen to believe they were, but even if they weren't, it makes no difference. They were immoral, understanding that they were transgressing barriers. And that then is restricted to a matter of morality and immorality. So you decided you wanted to transgress the barrier, that's your business, and you did it. But today you don't transgress the barriers. There's just this feeling of guilt without being able to cope with it somehow, because you don't really know if what you did is right or wrong. And you can't really understand if what you're doing, what you're setting out to do, is right or wrong. There isn't even the pleasure of transgressing anymore, unless you're religious. There isn't. There's nothing you can do which is transgressing anything. I'm not talking from a legal point of view, but from a moral point of view. This is the kind of reason why I don't want the tapes, too many tapes hanging around. But even theoretically, for those who indulge in that kind of thing, adultery isn't any more fun anymore. Because it's permitted. The whole fun and challenge of adultery for those people who engaged in it was the excitement of transgressing. Today it's not transgressing, so what? Even that starts to become boring. That's how far we've gone. Where even an Avera has no excitement to it anymore. But we'll come to that kind of thing a little bit later. I just want to describe to you briefly the atmosphere of insecurity with which a young couple approach marriage. Bearing in mind, too, that the two of them have just gone through a period of adolescence. And adolescence, by the way, is nothing physiological. There's no physiological condition called adolescence. And adolescence is something newly created, in fact, in previous generations, certainly in Jewish circles, and for that matter in all circles. There wasn't such a thing as adolescence. Adolescence is also part of this whole society that we've created. Human beings who are emotionally and intellectually capable of leading responsible lives and are not permitted to do so by the society in which they live, by the parents, by the schools, the universities. The continued spoon-feeding of an adult is what creates an adolescent. And so these two people have gone through a period of adolescence, striving for independence and feeling themselves being controlled. Feeling insecure as a result of nuclear threat, technology, family or lack of family, economic pressure, permissiveness, whatever you want. They feel totally without boundaries, totally without a place in which to operate. Come together in the hope, in the dire hope, that in their togetherness, they'll find, in addition to many other things hopefully, but essentially one thing, and that's security. We also mentioned last week how much more urgent the woman's need for security was than the man's, since she was dependent on him for so much. Now we're ready to look at these definitions of marriage. Not definitions of marriage, but these bases for marriage that we're given. Let me just read them out to you again and see if you can spot what's common to them all. Oneness, mutual respect, understanding, communication. Compatibility, give and take, loyalty, trust, tolerance and consideration. Similarity of goals, confidence in each other, each person recognizing their own worth, and love. What would you find is common about all of those? What element do they all have? Absolutely right. They're mutual, and that's where you've all made a mistake, ladies and gentlemen. That's not the basis for marriage. standard. Everybody makes this mistake. And that's where all the mistakes of later marriage come. And the first session of marriage counseling, that's what we find. Now what I'm going to say is going to sound, in a sense, a little bit male chauvinistic in the beginning, but ladies, don't worry. By the time we're finished, you'll feel happier. The success of a good business, or the success of a good partnership even, or the success of a country, any group of people operating together, basically depends on one thing, on the competence of the leader of the group to know where he's going. Have a group of people without a leader and you have chaos and unhappiness. Have a group of people with a leader, you have disagreement, you have debate, you have argument, you have discussion, you have love, you have all sorts of things. But you don't have unhappiness. We must understand that it is possible to argue and yet be happy. Argument is not a symptom of unhappiness. The whole Gemara is based on argument. Every page of it is filled with argument. And there's no greater bliss, as anybody who's tried it will know, than involving oneself in those arguments. Argument is not a cause for unhappiness. Argument can bring about tremendous richness among people and between people. But there needs to be direction. There needs to be argument within a framework. There needs to be argument within a structure. An argument with a certain purpose. Now to start off with this business of common ideals and common goals and mutual this and mutual that, it's all very idealistic and it has to come to that, but that's not the basis. Because it's unlikely, if not impossible, that you're going to find two individuals who are in fact individuals, not just products of a mass-produced society. It's unlikely that you're going to find two individuals as different as male and female, and as we discussed last week, hopefully not even similar as people, but complementary as people. How unlikely is it that you're going to find two such people who are going to have all these mutual wonderful things? They're going to have a oneness. You know, oneness, we're talking about a basis for marriage, so we're talking about what there has to be from the beginning. It takes years and years and years of hard work to reach the oneness, if it can ever be reached. It's very idealistic. It's an ideal which a marriage should have, but it's not a basis. The marriage can't start on that. It's unfair to ask of a young couple who hardly know one another. No, not who hardly know one another. Who don't know one another. To start their marriage out with oneness. It can't be. Mutual respect and understanding. Goodness me, to understand another human being. There are people that I've known for years and I still don't understand them, including my wife. It's just we'll talk about understanding to another, how hard one has to struggle to understand another human being. But it's not something you can start with under the chuppah. It takes a long, long time to understand another person. Compatibility. That's also something which is not granted, but achieved. Compatibility is not, somebody asked last week about sexual compatibility and so on, and we said we would still discuss it. But altogether, all forms of compatibility, including sexual compatibility, are not granted. Compatibility is something which has to be achieved and worked on over a long period of time. Give and take, loyalty, trust, a whole lot of them. They're all wonderful ideals which hopefully a marriage will achieve. But they're not the basis. That means the marriage doesn't start with them. And secondly, it's not the end of the world if they're not there. If there's no oneness, or there's not mutual respect, I'll explain that still a little bit later, or the compatibility isn't 100%, or there isn't quite 100% give and take, a marriage can survive all those things that can be. But a marriage can't survive the husband not playing his role. And here we start off by putting the full onus for the success of the marriage, I'm sorry to say, gentlemen, on the husband. Because that's where it starts. The relationship has a certain dynamics which will develop, that somebody has to trigger it off and somebody has to watch and steer it. And that somebody happens to be the husband. Again, you'll understand this as we go on and the whole thing becomes a little bit clearer. But at this point, that's what we've got to understand. Imagine the husband and wife meeting each other under the chuppah in their feelings of insecurity and throwing their arms around one another in the hope that in one another they'll find security. Why should they find security in one another if they're both running to the other to find security? If A is running to B because A is insecure, and B is running to A because B is insecure, how is it possible that two insecure people are going to make one another secure? It's asking for too much. The man has to take charge. The man has to understand that this is his responsibility. When he's getting married, and that's what I mean by a basis to marriage, before a man stands under the kippah, he's got to understand what he's doing. And what he's doing is he's taking one massive responsibility. And that has to be clear. He has to understand the full nature of that responsibility. There's a Medrash in Kohelet which uses the following words. Well, there's based on the verse. The verse is Tov legever yisa ol min urav. It's good for a man to assume responsibility while he's still young. Now the word ol means more than responsibility. It means weight. It means almost burden, yoke. That's really what ol means. It's good for a man to assume a yoke while he's young. And the Medrash says, what does that all mean? What is the yoke that a man is meant to assume? It's the yoke and the responsibility of marriage. That's it. Ol Isha. The yoke of a woman. Now that sounds very dramatic and unromantic, but again, it's going to need a little bit of discussing in order to clarify it. But the first thing that one wants to clarify is that whereas there's going to be a very important place for romance, which we're going to be coming to next week, the basis, the point on which it all starts, is not romance, but responsibility. And it's a one-sided responsibility. We'll come to the woman's roles and to her, the aspects of her responsibility and so on. But they will all flow out of a man correctly having assumed his responsibility. A man has to understand that when he gets married, he's undertaking the responsibility of a woman. In what way? Firstly, note the Hebrew word we use for marriage. The Hebrew word we use for marriage is nisuin. Nisuin means to bear, to carry. I understand in some other classical languages that the word for marriage has a similar meaning. And only English, in terms of old languages, has the kind of construction with the word marry where a man and woman can get married. In Hebrew, a man and woman can't get married. A man can marry a woman, that's all that can happen. And in Latin and Greek it's the same. A male can marry a female. Man and woman can't get married. Get married isn't like standing outside in the rain. Two people do it together. Somebody has to do it. And that's why the whole emphasis under the chuppah is on the man doing certain things. The man gives the woman a ring as an act of purchase almost. He's bearing her. He's taking her over. He's buying her from herself, so to say. He's taking a certain ownership in her. It's an act. Marriage in Hebrew is an active verb and it's a transitive verb. It has an object. You don't get married, you marry. And not anybody marries, only men marry. And they marry only women. Man marries wife. Husband marries wife. Man marries woman. That's the relationship and that's where it has to start. The responsibility is basically the responsibility of ownership. Now, I don't mean ownership in a derogatory way that a wife has to show him as a piece of furniture owned by her husband. Again, we'll understand as we go along what ownership means. Unfortunately, we live in such a materialistic society that when one thinks of ownership, one thinks of money. But the ownership we're talking about is something more subtle than that, and more powerful than that. The Hebrew word for a husband is a baal. Baal means owner. That's the relationship. That's what you're doing under the chuppah. You're investing in something. You're taking all you have and you're investing. And to hear a man in marriage counseling sessions later on complaining that his wife did such and such, or his wife is responsible for such and such, is absurd as to hear a man claiming that he lost all his money because a business he invested in went bankrupt. Not the business that went bankrupt. You went bankrupt. Either you invested in the wrong business, or if you were the manager of that business, you didn't know what you were doing. That you can't buy something and blame the thing for the failure. You can't buy a car and when the car doesn't drive properly, blame the car. Either you're not driving it correctly or you were a fool to buy a defective motor car. But don't kick the car, it's not his fault. And so it is in the husband-wife relationship. The husband takes complete responsibility for the wife. He is marrying her, nobody asked him. He proposes to her, he gives her the ring, she can refuse to accept it. that he's the one who was the man who was active, the party who was active in the whole transaction. He purchased her, so to say. He invested in her. And from now on, he is responsible for everything she is, and for everything she does, and for everything she becomes. Now there is an out, there's divorce. Which again, is an option which he has more than she has. Not as simple as that, she also can object to a divorce. But basically it's a step which he, the purchaser, has to take to release himself of his purchased investment. But as long as he doesn't opt for divorce, no excuses. You are responsible, you the managing director. That's it. And as it would be absurd for a managing director to hide behind the actions of his subordinates and say, sorry, I didn't know this was going on. Or sorry, I wouldn't have handled it that way. That's a nasty thing to do. That's not the way you treat your subordinates. And it's cowardly. And it's absurd. What kind of a managing director are you if you don't know what your employees are doing? What kind of a managing director are you if you choose the kind of employees you can't trust? And what kind of a husband are you if you're not in control to the way your wife is functioning, and if you chose a wife whom you can't trust? Therefore a husband, certainly as far as the public is concerned, can never put the blame on his wife. He is the husband, he is the managing director, he is the leader, and he takes responsibility. How does one achieve this ownership? Again, symbolic under the marriage of giving the ring. With money, you buy. But that's only symbolic. The ownership, the relationship of ownership, is one which takes a longer time to develop. It's not something which happens immediately. The first important element in ownership is understanding of what you own. A person who doesn't understand what they own can't express his ownership of the thing. Again, I'm making no comparisons, but if you don't know how your television set works, you can't own it. I mean, it can be yours legally. But you can't own it, you can't master it if you don't know where to switch it on. And you can't master your dog if you don't know how a dog operates, if you don't know what makes a dog tick. There's no way you can relate to the dog in a way where the dog feels that he's relating to a master. And there's no way a husband can relate to a wife unless he understands that wife very intimately. That also takes a bit of time. And I'm briefly going to discuss the main areas in which this understanding is necessary. Call it sensitivity, call it understanding, call it whatever you want. It's in two areas. It's in understanding the uniqueness of a woman. Most of my remarks at this stage are addressed to the man. We're going to come at the end. Back around to the women's side, but since man and woman are so different, I'm treating them separately, the responsibilities of man and woman separately. The husband has to understand the uniqueness and different separateness of his wife as a woman, as a member of the female species as opposed to the male species, and he has to understand her as an individual. That's the first important element in understanding. Let me give you some examples of where this understanding becomes so vitally important. The example I've often given. The Queen works very hard. She has an unenviable position. She has long hours, unpleasant working conditions, and for what she does, I don't even know if she's that well paid. La'adil. A domestic servant in South Africa also works very hard. And she's also got difficult working conditions and she also isn't paid too much. What's the difference between them? Why would one rather be a queen than be a domestic servant? What difference does it make when both of them are working hard and not being paid adequately? The difference is really very simply that at least when the queen goes outside her palace, there are people waving at her and cheering her and flags are up and people go crazy for her. They love it. They respect her. They admire her. And so she doesn't mind all the work. And that's in fact something which keeps all of us going. If we feel somehow that we're getting feedback and we feel somehow that there's appreciation and admiration for the efforts we're making, we don't mind making those efforts so much. Whereas the poor domestic servant finishes her job and she goes outside and there's no Rolls Royce waiting for her, not even a Cadillac. And there are no guards outside the house to salute her for the day's work she's done. she disappears into a kind of oblivion, like all of us do when we come home from work. Now let's examine, is a wife a domestic servant or is she a queen? We talk very romantically about the Jewish view of the woman in her home as a queen, but let's see what she does. She cleans the house. She cooks and bakes. She cleans the dishes. She cleans the toilets. She changes the babies. In South Africa too, more and more. Works from morning till night. Works very hard from morning till night. That's no queen. And certainly in other countries where it's even more difficult. And I tell you that in South Africa, supervising the servants doing all these things is about as difficult as doing it yourself. So don't sit back and think that the women here have it easy. They have it jolly difficult. And the work that a woman puts in, the nature of the work and the severity of the work, is the work of a domestic servant. That's what she does. And that's also something that a husband and wife or a young couple have to understand before they get married. You know, what is marriage based on? Love, compatibility, mutual respect, understanding, companionship, all that. No! Love is based on, marriage is based on cleaning the dishes and cleaning the floor and cleaning the windows and changing the babies and getting up in the night and cleaning the toilets. That's really what most of marriage is about. That's how most of the time is spent. You can't start it off with all these ideals. The ideals penetrate later. One has to understand that the real nitty-gritty of living is servant's work. It's not romantic and idealistic. And yet it's possible to make the woman feel like a queen. One simple way. And that's when she's finished cleaning the toilets and washing the dishes, that she should feel that same kind of admiration that the queen feels when she goes outside and back in the palace. It has to be the same. And it can be the same. As the queen, after a drained day of working and meeting stupid people and having to make stupid comments, she comes out and she sees her people going crazy for her, and that fills her with a drive to carry on the next day. So a wife can be driven by admiration, respect, love, to carry on operating the next day. And where there isn't that admiration, respect and love, she's a servant without pay. And she feels humiliated as a servant without pay. And the marriage starts cracking up. That's one of the first areas where it starts going. That's the first area where the romance starts disappearing. Because she finds what she thought was going to be a wonderful marriage is a chore. That's all it is. And she gets nothing in return for that. And the halakhic instruction is that mechavda yoter migufa, you've got to honor your wife more than you honor yourself. One has more respect to her and you respect yourself. Respecting yourself is measured by the degree to which you can tolerate humiliation or even just being ignored. People don't like being ignored and they don't like being humiliated. Well, as much as you don't like it, your wife likes it less. And the instruction is to make sure that you pay more attention to her needs for yichus and kovod, for honor and respect, than your needs for honor and respect. And that's a halakhic instruction. That's how a Jewish person lives. And a man, a human being who keeps Shabbat and keeps Kashrut and keeps all the other do's and don'ts of the Torah and doesn't fulfill this instruction is, as far as we're concerned, not really a religious man. It's a man who's going through the motions but not functioning as a religious man. The Chaim Vital, in fact, said that the whole status of a man is measured not by how he keeps Shabbat and how he keeps Kashrut and whether he puts on tefillin and how many times a day he doesn't, not even by the charity he does in the community and the sick people he goes to visit and all the wonderful kindnesses he does for any needing soul. The real measure of a man's stature is watch how he relates to his wife. That's all you need to know. That will tell you everything you need to know about him. Because that's where you'll see whether he's really a mensch or he's a mensch for show. Because behind the closed doors of one's own house and even more one's own bedroom, there's no show. That's just for real. And that's when we behave our real selves. The man who comes home from work grumpy and miserable and starts complaining as soon as he walks in, why isn't supper ready, and falls into a chair with a drink and a newspaper open in front of him, that's who he really is. That's the man. You must picture him doing that all day because that's what he is. The fact that he's a successful businessman or professional, the fact that he does a lot of charitable work outside when people are watching, that doesn't matter. He's a grumpy, miserable old individual. That's what he is. He hasn't the faintest clue as to how to relate to human beings. That's what he is. That's where you look to understand how a man operates. The second area, which is tied into the first, is to understand a woman's domesticity, a wife's domesticity. No matter how intelligent a woman is, no matter how academic she is and how intellectual she is, we discussed last week the difficulties of a woman being intellectual and academic. But no matter how intellectual and academic she might in fact be, when she gets married, there is nothing more important in the world than her home. There should be nothing more important in the world than her home. Whereas before her marriage, what was important was getting to her lectures on time or making way in her career and achieving and success and reaching the top and traveling overseas and going out on Saturday nights. The moment she gets married, as she walks in the front door, what becomes important is, did the meat delivery arrive, and does the butcher have her order, and what kind of fruits and vegetables can she get? These all of a sudden become major areas of concern, and quite rightly so, because that's her first responsibility. Career and everything else now becomes secondary in a sense. Not in a sense, becomes secondary to her primary responsibility, which is caring for her family. And now caring for her family becomes terribly critical and terribly important. I'll come back to domesticity in a moment. I just want to revert to honor and respect in the understanding that a woman sacrifices an awful lot when she gets married. She hopefully gains an awful lot too, but there's tremendous sacrifice of personal advancement and career. In other words, all the things outside the emotional happiness of the home, she basically sacrifices. The man doesn't. He remains part of that. But the woman gives all that up to a large extent. When she comes into the house, her whole orientation revolves around pleasing her husband. Believe it or not. That's certainly how the marriage starts off and how it's meant to continue for very, very many years. When a wife goes to the shop to buy clothes, she looks at what she likes. But finally, when she's choosing between two dresses, what will decide is how she thinks her husband will respond. Which will he be happier about? Which will he like better? When she goes out to look for some furnishings for the house, when she's looking for curtains or she wants to paint the place, finally what she's going to decide is which is going to arouse his excitement more, which is going to make him more stimulated, which is going to make him more pleased with what I've done. That's how it is. Imagine then a woman who goes into a shop and buys herself a dress. After a lot of thought and planning and saving, and finally the great day has come, she's going to the shop. And she looks at a whole range of dresses and she cuts out those which she doesn't like at all. Now she's left only with about 50 that she likes. And now starts the whole question of which it will be. So she cuts out the cheap ones and she cuts out the very expensive ones. Now she's left with only about 30. And now she starts imagining the moment she walks into the lounge where her husband is sitting having a drink in her new dress. And she figures his reaction in this dress, and she figures his reaction in that dress, and she tries it on, and she looks in the mirror, and she doesn't see herself, she sees her husband looking at her. And she wonders, and she worries, and she thinks, and she doesn't know, and finally she hits on the right one. It's not exactly her taste, but she knows it's exactly his taste, that's just what he likes. And she buys it. And she takes it to be altered, and to be made right, and finally the great day arrives. And she gives her husband an address and she says, just wait for me, darling, I'm just going to get changed. And off she goes to the bedroom to get changed. She comes back, she says, I'm ready to go out now. He says, right, come, let's go. Imagine the complete feeling of letdown. Imagine the complete feeling of humiliation. The feeling of, in a sense, of tragedy. He hasn't even noticed. She spent hours and hours planning and plotting to make him happy. And he didn't even notice. Okay, so she gets over it. I know it happened. And okay, but they're still in love, it doesn't matter. And they have to come running out. And next day she decides she's going to tidy up his study or his den or his workshop or wherever it is that he messes around. And she goes and she puts on her old clothes and she gets the polish and the dusters and she gets busy and she cleans everything up, spick and span, beautiful. One of two things are bound to happen. If the man is an exceptionally sensitive human being, he'll walk into his study or his den or his workshop and he'll do what he has to do there. And he'll walk out again without having noticed that anything was done. If he's not quite so sensitive, he'll start shouting and screaming, "Where's my pen?" Brings some flowers into the house. She buys a new tablecloth. She cooks something very special. And he doesn't notice. He doesn't comment. You know, when a woman prepares a meal, she doesn't cook what she enjoys. She doesn't make what she likes. That's one of the sacrifices she makes when she gets married. She's basically never going to eat the thing she likes. That's basically what it is. Unless he's particularly generous and they're living in a community endowed with many kosher restaurants, at home she's not going to be eating what she enjoys anymore. She's going to be eating what he likes. And usually women's taste is more sophisticated than men's, and they suffer. That's made up for by the pleasure of giving him what he enjoys and what he likes. And he comes in, he sits down to supper, and he gobbles it down, or eats it politely, it doesn't make terribly much difference. And he starts talking about business and work and what he's worried about and this and that. And what she's devoted her whole day to. So a woman, by virtue of her being a woman, is domestic. Her life revolves around the home and particularly around her husband, or should do. And ladies, if any of you are married and your lives don't revolve around your husbands in your home, please see me or some other competent marriage counselor as soon as possible, because it's not right. And thirdly, a woman is incredibly emotional. She's a bundle of emotions. She's feeling. That's her strength. That's her great, great strength. Her feelings are not a part of her. Her feelings are her. And she is her feelings. And to hurt a woman's feelings is not like hurting a man's feelings. It's not very easy to hurt a man's feelings. But if he's a man, if he's a little boy, you can hurt his feelings. If he's a man, it's not that difficult, because a man is capable of abstracting his feelings from himself, as we discussed last week. A man can separate himself and his feelings, and he can look at them objectively. But to hurt a woman's feelings, you're hurting her, physically, emotionally, and psychologically. Whereas with a man, one man can come to another and say, "You know, you told me yesterday, ABC, I think you're talking nonsense." If you tell a woman that you think she's talking nonsense, it's like telling a man that he looks like a hunchback. And you're criticizing him. It's not something that he said or did. A woman's feelings, that's who she is, that's her. It's not a part of her, it is her. One has to be terribly careful. And particularly in light of the first two things that I mentioned, the extent to which she is domestic and to which her life revolves around him, that you have to realize that her domesticity is feeling. When she buys that dress that we described, or she brings a vase of flowers onto the table, or she reorganizes the furniture, that's all feeling too. That's not practicality. That's not because she just wants the house or thinks the house functions better. And if it is practicality, it's because she reasons that her husband will find pleasure in a more practical and efficiently run home. But it's all feeling, it's all emotion. And to walk in and not to notice that emotion, or to notice it in an unpleasantly critical way, in an insensitive way, is something which debilitates a woman completely. That doesn't mean that one always has to compliment and never criticize, because a woman doesn't like that either. She gets upset when you criticize, but if you never criticize, then she says that you're not being honest because you never criticize. You always just say it's fine. So sometimes one has to be critical and you have to express your taste. You have to say, "I don't like that dress. Not a nice one. Sorry." She might be very upset, but deep down she'll be happy that you care enough not to like it. And if you don't have that, if there's never that feeling of critical ability about the thing she says, does, and buys, and organizes, then there's a feeling again of lack of care of not doing it. So one has to, I'm not saying one has to compliment, just one little thing. One has to notice, and one has to respond. You have to notice everything your wives do, that everything, and you have to respond to everything. You might choose the response of silence, but that must be a chosen response. It mustn't be neglect. You might decide, I'm not going to comment. Okay, that's fine. That's also a response. But it mustn't be, I'm not going to comment because I didn't see. If you're not going to comment, that's your choice. You have to notice everything, and you have to respond to everything. And if you don't, your first expression of ownership is lacking in the sense of a total lack of understanding of whom you're married to. A total lack of understanding of what a wife is, and what a woman is, and what a woman needs to be. Complete absence of that understanding. And if you don't understand your hefter, you don't master it. If you don't master it, you start feeling insecure ultimately. We'll come to that later. One has to also understand that a woman, being as emotional as she is also irrational at times. And a man must never get angry or impatient with a woman's inability to see male logic. Because I assure you, she thinks your logic is as irrational and crazy as you think her irrationality is. It doesn't make any sense to her at the time when she's feeling very emotional about something. And it doesn't help to sit and reason. This doesn't work. The Gemara says when a man, I think we quoted it last time, when a man has just lost a close friend or a close member of his family and the body is still lying in front of him, don't come to him and tell him that everything is alright and start comforting him. When a man feels emotional, don't talk to him rationally. Once the emotions are over, then you can rationalize. Not at the outset. And don't expect women to become like men. Just think to yourselves how difficult it is for you to change a habit. Never mind a deep character trait. Just a habit, how difficult it is. And don't always expect, why can't you change? Why can't you do this and why can't you do that? Just understand that there are certain things which are inherently female. And that's what you married. That's the all. That's the responsibility you took when you got married. And you can never turn around and say, but she's anything. That's what you married. So the first one is understanding. The second one, is imposition. Imagine again, let's take the example of the car. Man has just bought himself a beautiful Mercedes-Benz. And he's now going to master it. What does he do? He spends his whole Sunday washing it and polishing it and dusting it. And he stands in admiration. Every morning he has a look at it. And he talks to it fondly and he pats it and he cuddles it. And he keeps it warm. And he puts it away in the garage always. And he puts a heater into the garage. He gives it everything it needs. That's not what a car needs. A car needs to be driven. That's when you become master of your car, when you drive it competently. Don't say a wife needs to be driven.
Or locked in the garage.
That's all locked in the garage. But a wife needs to feel again that she's serving a purpose, that she is wife. And for that a husband needs, I think that the words are a little bit unfortunate, and I want you just to wait until we finish the discussion before you actually define it in your mind. We're using English words which are inadequate. But when I talk about it, a man has to impose himself on his wife, you'll understand soon what I mean. The most miraculous thing about a woman is the degree of her adaptability. A man is totally incapable of conceiving to what extent a woman is capable and in fact does adapt. She goes through a much more severe adaption process in marriage than a man does. A man basically carries his lifestyle on, so he's now married instead of being single. But she changes completely. There is hardly any similarity to her life after marriage as to what it was before marriage. And she adapts. And she adapts to his value system. And she adapts to his lifestyle. Sure, he adapts a little bit here and there too. But not in major things. She's the one who's constantly being called upon to make the sacrifice of adaption, and she does it, and she does it successfully. Provided she admires the person for whom she's adapting. We'll come to that later on. Assuming that her side is okay, we'll just describe still what her side is, she's capable of the most amazing adaption. And she finds great pleasure in adapting to what he wants of her, again, provided she admires him. Obviously, nobody wants to adapt to somebody they don't admire. But to adapt to that which her husband wants of her, where she admires her husband, That is one of the greatest fulfillments that there can possibly be. But then he needs to impose on the marriage what he wants of her. What he wants of the marriage, what he wants of the home. There's got to be direction coming from him. She's got to get the feeling that she knows what he wants of her. She can do all sorts of miracles. She can make the house work. And by house, I don't mean the bricks. I mean the home. She can build a home along the plan which he has designed. The moral and emotional and psychological plan which he has designed. But she must know and understand that plan. And if she feels he has no plan, she finds adaption impossible. Obviously, what does she adapt to? So it's necessary to impose a direction on the marriage and to let a wife know clearly what you like, what you dislike, what moral behavior you approve of, what moral behavior you don't approve of. Not only her moral behavior, but the world in general, others. She must get a feeling by how you see the world as to what your moral system is. You must comment to her. You must point out to her if you believe that something you've read in the newspaper or a book that you've read or a movie that you saw or real people that you encountered, if there's something you believe is inherently wrong there, you must explain it and show your wife and share with your wife a moral system that led you to that conclusion. And you must have conviction in that moral system, because if she senses that you don't believe what you say, then she loses total respect for you. And she might argue with me and she might disagree with you, and that doesn't matter, that's fine. But you slowly, through debate and discussion, you're slowly introducing her to a moral system to which she's ultimately going to adapt. She might play a part in the formation of that moral system through her influence on you, that's how it should be. But finally, it's a moral system which you're imposing. And it doesn't help talking about a moral system if that moral system isn't adhered to. And it needs to be adhered to certainly by the husband, consistently. And even more important, when that moral system isn't being adhered to by the wife or the children, the father needs to put his foot down. The wife must feel that he cares enough about the moral system to risk an argument over it. She feels that rather than have an argument, he's going to keep quiet about a moral system, and she feels a complete lack of confidence in that moral system. A man is not a gavra, he's not a gever, he's not a man unless he believes in certain things, lives those things, and insists that that system is adhered to in his home and in his family. And it needs to be an insistence which during the first years of marriage lead to major, not minor, quarrels and arguments. And those quarrels and arguments later become the foundations on which the home is built. When those quarrels and arguments are absent, it's not because it's such a lovely, peaceful, romantic marriage. It's because it's a husband who has nothing worth fighting about. That's really what it is. He isn't laying down anything which is sufficiently meaningful and real for the woman to feel like kicking against. It needs to be a way of operation. These are the things we do in this house, and these are the things we don't do, and we never do. Nobody. And that has to be made very clear and lived according to that. Politeness, one must be careful of. Politeness is a relationship invented by the British or Anglo-Saxons in general to ensure that people who hate each other's guts can still relate in a normal human way to one another. But politeness is not for an intimate behavior. Honor and respect, yes. Not politeness, there's a difference. Politeness is superficial, it's something which causes a barrier between people. It's not something which bridges a gap between people. And it's genuine honor and genuine respect. That same honor and respect that you show to the queen. That's what you need. The woman has to feel not only respected and loved, she has to feel admired and adored. That's what she needs to feel. And if you are incapable of making your wife feel at all times adored, then you're not functioning as a husband. We'll come a little bit later to the fact that the woman must make very clear to her husband when he's failing in this area. Because unfortunately women get, I don't know, whether terrorized or just used to it, and they start ceasing to expect it from marriage. And when they cease to expect it, the pressure's turned off. And when the pressure's turned off, the husband doesn't give it. And that's when male impotence starts. But not only sexual impotence. The impotence of being a male, when you're not functioning as a male. A male needs to make his wife feel adored. And I don't know why it's so difficult for men to understand it. They understand it so well when they're courting. They understand it so well when they're dating. And they know exactly how to do it. And they know how to bring the flowers, may not have taken them out on dates, may not have showered them with gifts and with lovely words and to write them poetry and loving letters and do everything that a woman needs in order to make her feel adored. And a few weeks after marriage, it suddenly no longer becomes important. He's caught her, he's got her. I don't know what he thinks. But that aspect of marriage, which is perhaps the most important in their relationship, becomes less and less significant in their relationship. And it starts rotting and decaying. The woman starts feeling like a servant. And if she feels like a servant, she wants at least the independence and the freedom of the servant. She doesn't want to be committed to a home. That's because that would be slavery, not even being a servant. She feels like a slave. And there's unfortunately nothing in between, ladies and gentlemen. It's a feeling of being a slave or a queen. That's all a woman can feel in a marriage. We're running short of time. I've got to go just one step further at least. Because this is one of the biggest barriers to the man's relationship to his wife. Ownership requires giving rather than taking. If you need your things, if you need your objects, if you need your heftes, then you are controlled by them. You don't own them. Owning is the ability to give to them, to handle them, to utilize them correctly, but not to be the taker from them. A man who needs his money or needs his motor car or needs his mansion or whatever it is, and without that he wouldn't feel human. Without that he would feel less human or of diminished stature. Such a man is under the control of his material possession. He's not in control of his material possession. And a husband needs to be at all times, when he's being husband, given. And I must tell you that this really is, in our generation, is one of the biggest problems. A man does not, believe it or not, need to be loved. It's not a need of his. He is capable of enjoying being loved. He is capable of thriving on being loved, as everybody is. But it's not a need. He can live without being loved. He cannot live without loving. That's a need. A man needs to love. But a woman, it's different. A woman needs to love as well, and she has that relationship in the relationship that she has with her children. But let's leave that aside a moment. We'll come to that another time. In relationship to her husband, her need is to be loved, not to love. She needs to be loved. And God in His wisdom created two beings, one with an intense and overwhelming need to love, and one with an equally intense and overwhelming need to be loved. And He brings them together in marriage. What's gone wrong in our society is that we're producing men from childhood, unfortunately. That's the way we were raised. Who need to love. Who need to be loved. That's the big, big problem. The men that are being produced by our parents, by our schools, by our society, are not only men who don't need to be loved and need to be loved, but they're very often men who haven't the faintest clue as to how to love. They have a mind need to be loved. Need to love. And then you have a situation, as we have in most of our marriages, where you have two parties who have both have a desperate need to be loved. And who does the loving? Nobody. And so there's no love in their marriage. Love is a dynamic. It goes, it moves, but it has to have a giver and a taker. Someone has to be pouring and somebody has to be receiving. You can't have two empty utensils and they both need to be filled and put them together and lock them up together and say, you are now a married couple. What will they do? They'll shake and they'll rattle in their emptiness. You need one party whose need and whose ability is to love, and one whose need and ability is to be loved. And the woman, in everything that she is, in the physiological differences which we discussed last week and we will still discuss, and in the emotional and psychological and all the other differences, a woman is designed to be loved. That's what she's for. That's what gives her great fulfillment. And that is what gives a relationship with her such great fulfillment. And a man with all his designs, with all his physiological, psychological, spiritual and emotional structure, is designed to love. That's what he's designed for, to give love. the difference between a crutch and an instrument. Why is a violin called an instrument and a crutch is called a crutch? Why aren't they both called instruments or both called crutches? This is the difference. One you need, you're taking from. The man is a recipient of his crutches. A violin you're giving to, the violin incapable of making music on its own. I, the musician, am giving this violin fulfillment by playing it competently. And that's the relationship. A man who needs his wife for love uses her as a crutch. He has an inadequacy, and he needs her to fill his inadequacy. And a man who is inadequate doesn't command the admiration from his wife, which he's going to need for all the things which we've discussed up to now. There's no way a woman can command admiration for a man who never has severe problems. She can feel sympathy, she can get all maternal about him. She can feel sympathy for him and a certain kind of maternal love, but that's not marital love. And there's a tremendous confusion in our marriages today between maternal love and marital love. And one finds that women are being called upon to give maternal love to their husbands, and there is no marital love. Because marital love starts coming from him. She is the condition for his love. She is that which makes it possible for him to love. She is that which receives his love. And by receiving his love, she gives to him the greatest gift he could possibly have. Because without her, he can't love. And without loving, he can't exist if he's a potent, real male. And that's how she fulfills her role and he fulfills his role. A man is blessed with a tremendous, or should be blessed with a tremendous drive towards independence. Starts when he's a little kid. Wants to be independent. Doesn't want to be dependent on others. And that's the whole problem with adolescence, which we discussed in the beginning. That desire for independence continues through marriage. And again, many marital breakdowns occur because the man feels his independence restricted and threatened by his wife. He can't move as freely. He's got responsibilities which he didn't have before. And as a result of that, he starts expressing his independence in brutal and cruel ways. And that's not the way it's meant to be. Man is meant to be independent because a giver is independent, except that he needs somebody to receive from. But how do you express your independence? If somebody's done something for you, and when a husband and wife are living together, my goodness, she does an awful lot for you. How does a man ensure that with all that his wife is doing for him, he doesn't become belittled in his male role, which we've discussed? How do we ensure that he retains this independence, this ability to give, the stature that we're describing? How do we ensure that he doesn't become the little boy? He comes home and his wife has got food for him, and the house is clean, and everything's organized, and she pats him on the back, and she kisses him on the cheek, and she asks him how work was, just as his mother asked him how school was, and he falls back into the same kind of relationship which he used to have with mommy. How does he ensure that his male drive for independence is not affected? By one element, which in Hebrew we call hakarat hatov, which is the feeling of indebtedness for kindness. He must feel so overwhelmed by an indebtedness which he cannot possibly repay, that he does all he can to repay it emotionally. And he finds himself in a permanent state of indebtedness to his wife. And that's a relationship which the halakha prescribes. That a husband at all times feels himself indebted towards his wife. It has sexual ramifications as well, which, as I say, we'll discuss at the end. But emotionally, certainly, a man at all times has to be filled with a feeling of more than appreciation, absolute indebtedness to her. Wondering how he can possibly repay her for everything that she's done. And finding frustration almost and pressure in that he can't find enough means to really repay her. That doesn't mean that he becomes directionless. That doesn't mean he lets her do whatever she wants, because that's not what she wants. That means that while he continues to lead and to guide the marriage, he also searches daily for ways and means of expressing his indebtedness to her. I think because of time I have to leave it here. What I've got to do next week, before we even get on to what's scheduled for next week, is discuss the woman's responsibility. what she has to do, what's critical in her part of the relationship. Why I call this the basis of the marriage is because if this is right, you'll see next week, the woman's role flows almost automatically. The woman, strangely enough, apart from the adaptability which is involved in all the time and which requires great sacrifice, doesn't have to put much effort into the relationship if this first step is carried out correctly. If the husband is able to express his ba'alut, to express his ownership of her, if he's able to express his mastery of her through his understanding of her, through his imposition, through his leading of her, through his giving rather than taking, using her as an instrument rather than as a crutch, if she's able to feel that kind of movement, if she's able to feel that kind of relationship, it inspires within her the correct response, almost automatically. And next week we'll discuss what that response is, and how her response and his response then become the two pillars of the marriage, and how the dynamics works from there, right until the end, with a guaranteed success. And the success, last week I told you that I guarantee the success. This week I'll tell you even better. I'll show you next time that the Rambam, Maimonides, will guarantee the success as well of a marriage that functions this way. But these are the first steps that have to be understood. A man has to be a man, not a little boy, and not a girl. He has to be a male. He has to understand what's involved in being a male. He's got to understand what's involved in being a husband. Being a husband means carrying your wife on your shoulders. That means being a baal, it means possessing her, owning her, and she should feel possessed, she should feel owned. She should understand that and love it. That he should be sensitive to her, understand her deeply, know what's feminine about her and what that femininity means and is and how to relate to it. Understand the way she thinks and the way she operates. He needs to guide her and impose his ideals onto her. He needs to be constantly in the situation of giving rather than taking. Constantly in the situation of the gavra, of the subject, loving rather than being loved. His need mustn't be to love, to be loved. He'll get plenty of love, there's no question. Plenty of love he'll get, if this is the way he lives. But that mustn't be his need, that mustn't be his drive. His drive is to love, to give love, to express love. And she can bask in that love and respond to it in a way which we'll discuss next week. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Again, a little bit the same complaint that I had last time. I think it's a very heated target. I find it very hard to believe that the husband cannot, in some cases, need that love that you say from the wife. I find it a very automotive type of relationship that one person is the person who runs the show and the other one is the one who, in many ways, is being run for their own good, of course. But still this part looks
like... We haven't discussed yet what she does, or her areas of responsibility and her areas of authority, which we're going to still discuss, which are very great indeed. But yes, in the end there is one person running the show.
But isn't it possible to say that marriage is also very much a partnership?
And do you know any partnerships that have worked?
Many.
Where two people have had absolutely equal say in every decision?
I'm not talking about absolutely equal, but I'm just saying not necessarily in such neat and...
It doesn't have to be so neat and packed. Every couple works out, work out their own variations to the themes. You know, one can't come in and give a standard form which is going to work for everybody. We're talking about principles. The application of those principles is something which each person finds for themselves. And one couple will differ from another, depending on the needs and on the psychology of the particular individual. Yes, you will find men whose needs are to be loved, but then they'd better marry women whose needs are to love. And you can have a successful marriage with inverse roles. There are such things. There are many, many variations, obviously, but I don't want to keep you here for 365 weeks discussing all the possible variations. All I want to do is to give you the basis, the principles on which it is, that each person can take those principles, apply them to their own needs, goals, and ambitions, and slot their marriages into this type of guideline, into this type of direction, to reorientate it from the normal Western way of looking at things. Everybody's equal and everybody's the same and everybody looks the same and does the same and dresses the same and has the same rights. That's what we have to get away from and understand basically where the differences are and how and where those differences need to be expressed. But there will be variation, surely.
And I was just asking, didn't you say the part when you said about a man independent? How does this relate to his responsibility?
Yes, I see exactly what's worrying you. When a man can be, a person can be, no matter how responsible he is, he can retain his independence as long as he doesn't start needing what he's responsible for. Right? Independence is the ability, not having. Independence is not needing. That's really what independence is. When we talk about an independent man, we don't talk about a man necessarily who is a millionaire. We can have a poor man or an ordinary man who's also independently and financially independent. Because he doesn't lean on it, he doesn't need it, he's not psychologically dependent on his wealth or on his material being. So a husband who functions responsibly in the home, but sees himself as giving into that home, not needing the output from that home as much as giving into it. What he needs is to give. That's really, if we're talking about 100% pure male, one could say his only need is to give. He has no other needs in terms of a marriage structure. And if that's his only need, he's as independent as a human being can possibly be.
Sometimes that doesn't feel the restriction in the home.
Restriction is not an interference to independence. Everybody feels restricted everywhere. You can't do what you want in the world and you can't say what you want. And that doesn't interfere with independence. One can feel independent within a structure. And a husband has to know that there's a structure in which he has to operate. That if he feels in control of that structure, he feels independent. It's only when he feels controlled by the structure that he feels a lack of independence. That's the important thing that we're trying to get at, that a husband has to understand and start fulfilling a role where he doesn't feel threatened by his own family, because he feels responsible for that family. And therefore he's given a great deal of authority to go with that responsibility. Anything else? That's really a discussion all on its own on the raising of children, but basically we're not, in our education of children, we're not bringing out the male characteristics of the child, that is the desire and need and drive to give and to be creative and to contribute. We make them dependent on ourselves, and we teach them to enjoy that that dependence, and we enjoy that dependence, and we get upset when they begin to show a little bit of independence. We have to be careful to raise our children with a view towards independence, not dependence. Luckily, raising daughters is not as dangerous in our society, because at worst you'll raise your daughter to be dependent and one day she'll find a man to be dependent on instead of you. At worst. And she can be a good wife if she's dependent. It doesn't interfere with her female role. But a man who's dependent can't function as a man. There's more chaos, there's more destruction in the raising of sons than in the raising of daughters. In our Western society. In other societies it's different. In Western society, the damage is done to little boys more than to little girls. It's done very early on. In the very early years, the damage is already done, and it's compounded later on. In America, they've already described a condition for it, which they call momism. Which is not altogether... It's half correct. Perhaps at the end we'll have a chance to discuss it in a little bit more detail.
Where is the woman's free will responsibility?
That'll be coming to next week. Free will she has none. Responsibility she has plenty. Are you still going to come next week? We'll discuss that. She has a tremendous amount of responsibility. And
it is in relation to the fact that the man assumes responsibility for everything that she is in a marriage.
It leaves her in trying through persuasion and debate to influence her husband if she feels he's going wrong, in ways which we'll discuss next week. It leaves her to advance herself and develop her own potential. She mustn't sit back and wait for her husband to do everything. She's got to go on functioning and functioning and functioning. All that I'm saying is that when the husband sees that she's going over the line, she's got to give it a little tap and say, everything's fine, but not that. You've got to feel that she's functioning within the direction that he's laid down and is pursuing. But it doesn't mean that she just sits and waits to be schlepped along by the husband. She's got to drive herself too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, so we'll see you next week. Please, tea and coffee and cake and stuff is being served in the next door room. Make yourselves at home.